We've been strongly trying to encourage daily Bible reading among the congregation here this year, and well, not just this year, but we put special emphasis on it this year with our keeping a record of those that are participating in daily Bible reading and endeavoring to read through the entire Bible this year, or endeavoring to read through the entirety of the New Testament this year. It's an invaluable part of daily life. But if we're honest with each other, we have to admit that for many people, there are certain portions of the Bible that seem difficult to read. I can't tell you how many times I've had conversations with people who really didn't see any point in reading through all of the details of Exodus 25 and following, on all of the number of pillars in the tabernacle and the different kinds of fabrics that were going to be used to cover it and the different dimensions of those fabrics. Perhaps we come to a genealogy and all of those names of people that just don't register. The problem with approaching such texts in that way is that when I get so caught up in the names that aren't familiar, I miss the ones that are. Or when I get so caught up in the details that I think are not important, I might miss the ones that truly are. I might miss the fact that God's giving a pattern, Exodus 25 and following, and they built everything according to that pattern, Exodus 35 and following. I might miss the names that perhaps in a genealogy will later be seen in a genealogy in, say, Matthew chapter 1 or Luke chapter 3, the genealogy of Christ. There are other texts that are the same way that can be challenging to read, if you will. Take, for instance, texts where they're taking a census. Now, I'm not an accountant. There's a reason why I did not go to school for accounting, because I slept enough in class anyway. And were I to study that topic, I may have slept more. Some people are excited with accounting. To you, I say thank you, because folks like me need you. But it can be difficult to read a text that deal with counting. But that's exactly what the bookends, if you will, of Numbers are. The book of Numbers, if you'll open there, we're going to be in chapter 26. The book of Numbers begins with a census of the people of Israel. This census is taken year one of their journeys, just before they depart from Mount Sinai. The total number is 603,550. When we come to Numbers 26, God will tell Moses to take another census, make another count of the people of Israel. Numbers 26, beginning in verse 2, take the sum of all the congregation of the children of Israel from 20 years old and upward throughout their fathers' houses, all that are able to go forth to war in Israel. Moses, get a count of all of those that are capable soldiers, eligible soldiers. Now, the book of Numbers shows God organizing a disorganized people. We already noted that initial account in chapter 1. Chapter 2 and 3, he's going to tell them where to camp and how to march. And throughout the book of Numbers, we see God shaping them to be what they need to be for their journey. By the time we get to Numbers 13, they've arrived at the border of the land of Canaan. God has told them, although it's not contained in this text, but we see later in Deuteronomy, God tells them, you go up and possess the land. You're here. Now, if I were to ask you, how long were they in the wilderness? Most people would readily answer, 40 years. If I were to ask you, how long did it take them to get to Kadesh Barnea, where God first said, go up and possess it? Would you be able to answer that question? At this scene, God says, you go up, possess the land. They say, we want to send 12 spies. God tells Moses, Numbers 13, beginning in verse 1, go ahead, send some spies. So they go up and spy out the land. You remember the outcome. 10 of those spies brought back an evil report. We're too weak. The people of the land are great. It's a land that eats up the people of it. We need to make a captain and head back to Egypt. They rebelled against God, so God says, you'll die in the wilderness. And they would wander for a total of 40 years. But they were right there at the cusp of entering into the land of Canaan after only about a 2-year journey. It's just that they refused. So from Numbers 15 and following, there's a brief synopsis of the biggest part of their journeys. And most of it's complaining. Now, they complained back in chapter 11. They complained in chapter 12. They start rebelling against Moses and Aaron again in chapter 16. And then chapter 17, God indicates who the leaders are. But by the time we get to Numbers 26, that span has passed. It has been 40 years in the wilderness. And God says, Moses, you take account. This time the number is going to be 601,730. The number is going to be 1,820 less than it was 40 years earlier. They've lost in number. They have diminished. Now, this happened after a plague. That's Numbers chapter 25. God had protected this nation from the Moabites and the Midianites, who were looking at them from the mountaintop saying, we need God to curse these people for us. Hey, go get Balaam. And we'll, whoever he curses, God will curse. Whoever he blesses, God will bless. But God refused to curse Israel. God protected Jacob, as he would call the nation from time to time. God would not curse Israel. He said, I've not found iniquity in Jacob. So what happens? Numbers 25, after Balaam has departed from Balak, because God's not found iniquity in Jacob, God's not going to let them fall to the Moabites and the Midianites, Israel goes and joins themselves to Moab and Midian in fornication and harlotry and in idol worship. There's an old saying, if you can't beat them, join them. In this case, it was, if you can't beat them, get them to join you. A plague would take place in Numbers 25. Some 24,000 people would die because of it before the plague was ceased and the people had repented. The point, this count that is taken in Numbers 26 is taken after an immediate subtraction of some 24,000 people because of their iniquity. It's after the plague, Numbers 26:1. It's according to God's command, Numbers 26:2. And it's done just like that first count was done, 20 years old and upward. Why is all this important? Because if we just read Numbers 26 and we start only seeing digits, chances are a large portion of us are going to yawn. But if we will look for what's truly in this text, we may just learn something. Friends, when you read the Bible, let me plead with you, make it count. Even when you read texts that you might first peruse and think, well, I'm not sure why this is important to me, I promise you, there's application. Make it count. And as we survey Numbers 26 today, we're going to see how God makes it count. Now, the largest part of the chapter, it deals with the specifics of this census and the numbers, the population of warriors that were in each tribe. By the time we come to verse 52, we're looking at why there was a need for that numbering. God is going to divide a land inheritance for them in time to come, and this count is going to be the basis for it. Then verse 57, God numbers the Levites, although they don't get the inheritance quite like the other nations did. And the final verses will discuss names not numbered. A simple head count. And with the details God supplies, He's going to give them a glimpse of their past, a glimpse of their future, and a glimpse of where they are now. I submit to you that as we examine Numbers 26 this morning, we're going to see God help His people look back, look forward, and look around. We began with, by making a head count, God helps His people look ahead, look forward, look to the future. Why do we say this? Well, again, we've noted God has given the command for the head count, the census. Take the sum of the people, He says. Why? Let's go to verse 52 of Numbers 26. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, unto these the land shall be divided for an inheritance according to the number of names. Pause. They're not in the land yet. The inheritance is not being divided yet. But based on this census, this count, 601,730, and the different portions that were in each tribe, this is how the land will be divided. Why is God having them make this count? He's reminding them of something. I promised I'm going to give you this land, and you're going to receive it. I promised I'm going to bring you into the land of Canaan, and I'm going to do it. And by this number is how the land will be divided. How long would it be? between this census and the time that the inheritance would be given? Deuteronomy 2:14 tells us that the time that Israel spent in the wilderness, from the time they left Kadesh Barnea to the time that they were about to cross over into Jordan, they were in the 40th year. It had been 38 years from the time of that rebellion when they said, "No, God, we're not going into the land of Canaan. Those people are going to whip us. They're too big." 38 years they would roam. 38 years a generation would die. It had been 38 years when we get to this point, and we're talking about them being encamped at Shittim, according to Numbers 25:1. But how long would it be from here to the time of the giving of the inheritance? Well, keeping in mind that date of, or that time span of 38 years from Kadesh Barnea, flip over to Joshua 14 for just a moment. You remember a fellow named Caleb? He was one of those 12 spies. He was the one that said, "Let us go up at once and possess it, for we're well able to overcome it. If God delight in us, He'll give us the land." Those people, their defense has departed from them. God's on our side. Caleb was the one that said, "Let's do it. Let's stand with God." Years later, God had made a promise to Caleb. Caleb will receive the land that he saw when he went up as a spy. Joshua 14, picking up at verse 9, Caleb is speaking to Joshua when he says, "Moses swore on that day, surely the land where my feet trod would be my inheritance and my children's forever, because I wholly followed the Lord my God. Now behold, the Lord has kept me alive these 45 years, even since the Lord spoke this word to Moses." It had been 45 years when the inheritance was finally being given. 38 years they wandered in the wilderness after Kadesh Barnea. Therefore, now again, I'm not an accountant, but 45 minus 38, 7. 7 years between the time of this census and the time the inheritance would be given. God is giving them a glimpse into the future. God is preparing them for something that they will not taste immediately, but they can guarantee it's going to happen. God is helping them prepare for what lies ahead. God prepares Israel for where they're going, for what He's going to give them. There are battles still to be fought, but the inevitability of God's promise is obvious. Now, what about for us? I don't know about you, but whereas I would enjoy visiting what many call the Holy Lands just to see those sights, at the same time, I'm a little skittish about heading over there. I'm not looking to head to the land of Canaan anytime soon. But there's another place where I'm headed. And just as a little head count helped them remember where God was leading them, could the same be true for us? Let's ask this question. With a simple head count, is God preparing us for the future? Maybe we take a head count of the children that are eligible to be in Bible class and the ones that are actually there. When we take that head count, is God showing us an idea of what we're going to be seeing in years to come? Or maybe we take a head count of those children that are present in the morning worship service, but they're not there for pew packers in the afternoon. How many people know what pew packers is? It starts at 5:30. Calvin raised his hand. That boy knows. Starts at 5:30. It's meant for your children. To shape their future, mold their future, guide their future, put God in their future. Could a simple head count at those times give us a view of our future? What are we doing to our future when we teach children that God gets 1 hour a week? We're going to be there at 10, well, maybe 10:15. And if the preacher goes much past 11, we're going to be upset. God gets 1 hour a week. What are we teaching our babies? What are we teaching them when we say, "Well, you know, you need to care about what God says. You need to do what's right." "No, I don't feel like going tonight. I'm right in the middle of a good nap." What are we teaching our children when I say my nap's more important than pew packers? What are we teaching our children when I say, "You know, I stayed up just a little bit too late last night watching Saturday Night Live. Let's skip Bible class." Why don't we just kneel down and say, "Son, I don't really love God, and I think I want you to go to hell too. Why don't we? When we teach our children God's not important, why don't we just come out and say what our actions are showing? Could we get a perspective of our future if we take a head count? Maybe the head count on Sunday night. Do we get an idea of who really cares? Do we get an idea of where their children will be? We sing a song, "When the trumpet of the Lord shall sound, and time shall be no more, and the morning breaks eternal, bright and fair. When the saved of earth shall gather over on the other shore, and the roll is called up yonder, I'll be there." What about when the roll's called tonight? Will you be somewhere else? It amazes me how many people will sing, "When the roll is called up yonder, I'll be there, but until then, I'll be wherever I want to be." If my being wherever I want to be here means I'm not with God's people when I can be, then when the roll is called up yonder, I'm sorry, but I won't be there. By making a head count, God helps His people look ahead to see the future. Let me ask you, is God important enough to be back tonight? By making a head count, God helps His people look back, see the past. It was George Santayana who was credited with saying, "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it." And indeed, it's true. Now again, think about what's taking place when we read Numbers 26. This is 40 years after the first count. It's 38 years after they've said, "No, God, we're not going to go where You want us to go. We're not going to do what You want us to do. We're not going to enter the land of Canaan." A large span of time has passed and many events have taken place. Consider all of the explicit and implicit reminders for the nation of Israel that are contained in this census and in this chapter. First, there's a reminder of how far they've come. They'd come from Kadesh Barnea in 38 years. They'd come from Egypt in 40. Now, I want you to consider the difference. And I want you to consider what will slow God's people down. Because that journey from Egypt, they went to Sinai and they camped at Sinai for 11 months. 11 months they were stationary. Then they pulled the tent pegs. They marched north, bound toward the promised land. And in 2 years' time, less actually, they were at the point of being able to enter the promised land. They traveled some 350 miles, perhaps a bit more, depending on how they moved around some of the terrain and geography. But the point being, they'd covered about 350 miles in 2 years, with 11 months of that being stationary. These people were moving all right. But then, after the events at Kadesh Barnea, after they said, "We will not go up," after God said, "Your carcasses will die in the wilderness," 38 years to go about 300 miles. 38 years compared to 2. 19 times as long to go not quite as far. When we, as did they, fail to take into account the power of God, our moving forward will be equally as slow. That was their problem. "We're not able to overcome this people," is what they said back in Numbers 13. They failed to take into account God is with us. When we make the same mistake, our progress will be equally depressing. Theirs was. But when we remember that it is God that works in us and through us, and that we are instruments of righteousness in His hand, the sky's the limit. And generally speaking, any time frame we would set, God can beat that. No, when we consider what's taken place here in Numbers 26 and this count, First, there's a reminder of how far they've come. It's a long way, but it's been a long time. It could have been a long way in a short time, were it not for the events of a rebellion. God helps His people look back at how far they've come, but also at how much they've grown. Consider, if you will, that first number was 603,550. Numbers chapter 1. The second census, 601,730. A difference of 1,820. Down, negative, below, diminished, decrease, minus, subtracted, less. They're not what they used to be. Look how much we've grown, or have we? You know, it would do us well to ask that same question from time to time. Look at how much we've grown, or have we? Look at how we're growing, or are we? Now, again, it's interesting. With this nation of Israel, the chapter before, there'd been the plague, when some 24,000 had died. In fact, glance back into Numbers 25 for just a second. Because one of the interesting things that shows up in Numbers 26 is some of the tribes had actually grown in number from the count at Sinai to the count at Shittim. Take Judah, for instance. They'd increased. Issachar had increased by almost 10,000. Manasseh by 20,000. But then there's one tribe, the tribe of Simeon, that had decreased by 37,100 individuals. Now, glance at something in Numbers 25. There is a member of the nation of Israel that has brought a woman of the Midianites into his home, and you can imagine what they're doing. They are sinning together. Eleazar the priest will be zealous for God and punish them for this. But notice of which tribe this man was. Numbers 25, looking at verse 14, the name of the Israelite that was slain, even that was slain with the Midianitish woman, was Zimri, the son of Salu, a chief priest of the house among the Simeonites. 24,000 people died in this plague. And one of the ringleaders was a ruler of Simeon. And that lone tribe lost 37,000 total over the course of 40 years. I wonder how many of those 24,000 came out of the tribe of Simeon. That tribe, in and of themselves, was cut in third. There's much to learn when we look at these numbers. There's much to learn about how growth takes place or doesn't. Now, we can ask this question. Would they have been better off had those 24,000 not died? Well, they would not have been better off had those 24,000 remained alive but maintained the same mentality that they had that led to their demise anyway. In other words, it wasn't just about numbers for God. It was about who will follow me. Had they grown in number? No. And in purity? No. That census was following a plague, and the plague resulted from fornication and idolatry. Now, had they abstained, there would have been more warriors. But they wouldn't have been warriors for God. We think about where we are today. Have we grown? In purity? I pray so. In number? It appears so. Will we continue to grow in real number and in true number? I hear so many times of congregations bragging about, well, we've grown this much in this amount of time. Well, I pray that it's true growth. But I've seen instances far too close to home, and by home, I don't mean Tennessee for me. Far too close to where we are. Where congregations will be at around, say, 60 on a Sunday morning. And then all of a sudden there's an increase to about 180. And all of a sudden, poof. It's like David Copperfield just did a disappearing act with half the folks. When we compromise doctrine in order to get a number on a board, we're giving up numbers and righteousness, because it will all fall apart sooner, usually, rather than later. That being said, are we growing in righteousness? Are we growing as God would have us to do? A head count helps us to look back. I realize that this congregation is not the number that it once was. And were I visiting and did not know any of the background of the congregation, I could have an idea that the congregation is not the number that it once was simply by doing this and that. The question that must be asked is why? Has it been that there have been natural tragedies, economic disasters, that have caused something of an exodus from the area? Yes. But are there other reasons? I can't always answer such questions. But as an individual among the congregation, I must be able to answer whether or not I'm contributing or trying to help fill said pews, if you will. When we look at where we are, we can remember how far we've come. How far have you come? We can remember how much we've grown. Have you grown? Or we can also remember that God punishes individuals. Now, Israel still had plenty of room to grow, but a lesson that should have stuck by this point was the fact that God was not going to tolerate their rebellion. You would think it would have stuck with all the different times that fire burned in the outskirts of the camp because of complaining, or plague struck the camp even as they ate the quail because of their murmuring and their desire for luxury. But even when we come to Numbers 16, we think about some people named Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And the reason we think of them is because in the text under consideration, Numbers chapter 26, their very names are mentioned. Numbers 26:9, this is that Dathan and Abiram which were famous in the congregation, who strove against Moses and against Aaron in the company of Korah when they strove against the Lord. There's a reminder given. This count that's made references people that are long since deceased, because they fought against God's leaders. Thus, they strove against God. And the penalty? Verse 10, the earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up together with Korah when that company died. What time the fire devoured 250 men and they became a sign. Now, God punishes individuals. They needed to learn that. But there's another thought that we can glean here. As we think about that head count, it was slightly diminished because some entire families were swallowed by the earth, as the description is given here. How many families have been swallowed by the world? How many times has it been the case that the number on that attendance board went down just a little because a family got caught up in their TV shows? Or a family got caught up in making sure Junior is at baseball on Wednesday or on Sunday morning or at soccer or at dance class or at cheerleading or at fill in the blank. I hope Junior's not doing cheerleading, but you get the point. How many times has it been the case that the world dangled a carrot that was more appealing to families than God's Word or than God's will? And how many times has that dangled carrot from the devil's worldliness led to less souls gathering with the saints, less souls reading God's Word, less souls growing together in righteousness? Remember, God punishes individuals. There's a reminder of that in this text. And the same is still true. For when I rebel against God's leaders, I rebel against God. And indeed, the world will swallow me up and welcome me. But there'll be a penalty in the end. Not only does God punish individuals, but another lesson from this chapter is that God punishes nations. Look at verse 63. The statement is made, these are they that were numbered by Moses and Eleazar of the priests who number the children of Israel in the plains of Moab by Jordan near Jericho. But among these there was not a man of them whom Moses and Aaron the priest had numbered when they numbered the children of Israel in the wilderness of Sinai. Another reminder of what had happened because of their rebellion at Kadesh Barnea. Verse 65, the Lord had said of them, they shall surely die in the wilderness. There was not left a man of them. All of those that were 20 years old and upward at the time of their rebellion had died in the wilderness. Friends, if we take a head count, we get an idea of the fact that God still punishes nations today. I'm not a doomsayer. I'm not the prophet or the son of a prophet. But I have no doubt that our very nation, as grand as she is and as much goodness as there still is, a potential that she still possesses, our very nation is suffering right now because of innocent blood. Because of the embrace of unrighteousness rather than the rejection of it. Because people want to vote for politicians that are going to pad their pocketbooks with someone else's money or that are going to tell them what they want to hear instead of being an influence toward righteousness in daily life and in a voting booth. Over 50 million. We get in an uproar about a man named Hitler and the deaths of 6 million Jews, and rightly so. 50 million. Genocide. Infanticide. Oh, but the term that's used today is abortion. If we take a head count of just those that aren't here because their mothers decided they didn't want them, we'd get an idea of why we're facing so much trouble today. God would tell Israel in this very book that He was spewing out the people of the land of Canaan because of the innocent blood that was shed. And when you shed innocent blood, the land will spew you out. If we take a head count, there'd be a lot we could learn. Remember how far you've come, how much you've grown, that God punishes individuals, that God punishes nations. But it's not all doom and gloom with this census. Because look at the latter part of verse 65. In that event, all the way back 38 years before, there were two men who stood up. They stilled the people before Moses. And they said, let's go up at once. We can take this land. Their names were Joshua and Caleb. Numbers 26:65, there was not left a man of them except Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Joshua the son of Nun. Another lesson to learn from this text, God rewards His faithful. Those who trust Him, those who desire to stand with Him, there's a reward available. God will protect, God will preserve, God will utilize, God will reward. It's more than just a census. It makes sense. It's more than just numbers. It's something that really counts. When we consider what God helped His people to see by simply making a head count, how much can we learn if we too would, by making a head count, look ahead at where we're going? Look back at where we've been and at the reminders that there's still a reward ahead. By making a head count, God helps His people look ahead. God helps His people look back, and finally, by making a head count, God helps His people to look around. Statements such as, the land will be divided, because they weren't in the land yet. They were not there yet. We think about the words of the Hebrews writer when he said, lay aside every sin, weight and the sin that so easily besets us, and run with patience the race set before us, looking unto Jesus. We don't run a race because we've already crossed the finish line. We run a race because there's still somewhere to be. We run a race because we're not there yet. Or as Paul put it when he wrote to the Philippians, Philippians 3, beginning in verse 13, I count not myself to have apprehended, but this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind, pressing ahead to those things which are before, I press toward the mark of the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. When God took this count of Israel, he gave them a reminder, there's an inheritance ahead of you, but you're not there yet. Like Israel in the land of Moab, we're not there yet. We've not gone as far as we can. It's not time for me to retire as a Christian. In fact, there is no age of retirement for a Christian. You think about the Apostle Paul, and had Paul worn a misfit or a U-fit or a get-fit or whatever the fitness device was on his arm, and I wear one too, so I'm not making fun of them, but had Paul worn one of those on his wrist, that thing would have just stayed lit up. With all the travel that he did and all the walking he did, not to lose weight, but to the glory of God. Even at the end of his life, the only thing that kept him from walking anymore was a chain. A Roman chain. And it was not until he knew his light was about to expire that he said, I'm already being offered. The time of my departure is at hand. I fought a good fight. I finished my course. I've kept the faith. 2 Timothy 4, beginning in verse 7. Not until Paul was at the finish line did he treat his life as though it were at the finish line. That must too be my mentality. I may have lost a step or two. I may not be as quick on my feet or as quick with my wit as I once was. That doesn't mean it's time to retire from serving the Lord. That doesn't mean that I cannot still encourage God's people by being with them. I might not feel good on Sunday morning. I guarantee that this attendance could have been doubled today were it not for the people that woke up and said, my pinky toe hurts. I might not feel good on Sunday morning. But I'm needed. I didn't feel good this morning. I've got a catch in my back. I can barely raise my arm. But I'm needed. When I realize that I've not gone as far as I can go, I might not go as fast as I once could go. I might not go as strong as I once could go, but I can go as wise as I ever went. And I can be as helpful as I ever was. It's just a matter of realizing I'm not there yet. You know anyone that was once with the church every time the brethren came together but now has better things to do? It's because that person is convinced that he or she has arrived. Doesn't realize he's not there yet. By making a head count, God helped his people to look around. Realize they've not gone as far as they can. They're still traveling to do. There's still a river to cross. There were still battles to fight. And like Israel and Moab, we've not grown as much as we can. They were smaller in number than they were when they got started. But they would grow. God had promised to make them as numerous as the sand of the seashore, more than could be counted. They could still count as of Numbers 26. In fact, they were less than they had been before. But they would grow. In number. And in many ways. If we look at the glory days of the nation. During this time of Joshua. And then later during the time of David. They grew both numerically. And they grew in purity. What they should have been. We can too. We've not yet done all the growing that we're going to do. In number, nor in faith. And if you've already grown as much as you're going to grow in faith, well, go ahead and talk with me because we need to schedule your funeral. Because the faith that's not growing is dead. And that's a sad state. Boy, Scott, some of those chapters of Scripture just bore me. All those different names, all those numbers. Stop. Make it count. Look at what's there. Invaluable lessons. And we've missed a dozen. Maybe 13. I'm not an accountant. A baker's dozen. But you get the point. Friends, by making a mere head count, look what God did for Israel. Let's ask ourselves a question this morning. What headcounts can help us? Is it going to help me when we make a headcount about who's doing daily Bible reading? Will it help me to pay attention to the headcount of whether or not I'm trying to read through the whole Bible this year, or at least the New Testament? I beg you, read the New Testament of the one who shed His blood for you and set a goal to read it this year. You might even be ambitious and read it twice. Is it going to do any good to get a count of those that are in attendance? We could stop counting and see what would happen. This morning, let's get a head count on this. Have you obeyed the gospel? God rewards the faithful, but the faithful are those who act in faith and follow the Lord. They repent of their sins, 2 Corinthians 7:10. They confess Jesus is Lord, and they're baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for the remission of sins, Acts 2:38. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, Mark 16:16. Do you have enough faith to do what the Lord said? This morning, take an individual head count. Have you been walking in faith, or have you been walking away? Why not turn around and come home? This morning, if you need to respond to the Lord's invitation, look back, look ahead, look at yourself right now, and make the right decision. Come forward while we stand together and while we sing.